This is Monitor, with the best of everything for your weekend entertainment. I'm your host, Brad Crandall. And starting off the festivities with Monitor Music is Skitch Henderson with All. Message meant for you.
Get with living the exciting way. Drink sparkling champagne like nothing else you ever tasted. Nothing else except champagne. So put more sparkle in your life today with sparkling champagne.
Sophisticated, you feel that way with champagne. C-H-A-M-P-A-L-E. Tastes like champagne. Buy it wherever beer is sold. Costs just pennies more. Sparkling Champagne Malt Liquor. Metropolis Brewery, Trenton, New Jersey. And now, a question. Did you ever hear of an actor who didn't change his name when he went into show business? A movie star who was born in Hollywood, or an actor who didn't originally start out to be something else besides an actor? Well, we have a guest tonight who's all three of those. On Broadway, he's appeared in The Rose Tattoo, Skin of Our Teeth. His movies have included Bus Stop, Hat Full of Rain, and Advise and Consent. His name is Don Murray. And to start with first things first, Don, were you really born in Hollywood?
Yeah, I was born in Hollywood.
Don't tell me you were born on that stool in Schwab's, you know. What he's talking about.
No, I was actually born in Hollywood Hospital. And I didn't know much of Hollywood, though, because when I was 9 months old, the Depression came and closed the studios, and my father came east again.
I see. Were your parents in show business at all?
Yes, my mother was a singer and a Ziegfeld girl, and my father was also with Ziegfeld and was a singer and a dancer and a stage manager.
I see. So you were pretty well started out. You were almost born in a trunk, even though not quite.
Yeah, I was. I spent most of my childhood was really marvelous because my father was with Olsen & Johnson at the time I was growing up.
Well, you grew up touring with things like Hells of Poppin' and
right,
with the Heat
right,
and stuff like that.
Exactly,
oh,
yeah.
Boy. Well, where did you finally get formal training as an actor?
At the American Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, I was quite surprised because before I went to the Academy, I actually didn't know that there was a drama and acting as an art form. To me, it was all pratfalls and pies in the face and falling out of balconies and,
right,
and a cake of ice on your lap. You
and
know?
That beautiful artificial fire hose that they used to throw at the audience filled with crepe paper.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah, they built those things so well. And really,
yeah, they were masters, really.
Well, now, when you went legit, so to speak, and discovered that it was an art form, you didn't do bad. You turned up with Mary Martin and Helen Hayes in the revival of Skin of Our Teeth.
Yeah, that's right. I played actually the part that was originated by Monty Clift on Broadway.
Mm.
And this was the revival, as you say, with Mary Martin and Helen Hayes.
From Olsen really Johnson to Mary Martin and Helen Hayes. Now, that's a jump.
It really is. That was a marvelous cast. They were terrific to work with, too. They were very, very gracious and kind people.
I wondered about this. Being young, this form of theater,
Working with two such distinguished ladies of the theater, did they go out of their way to help?
Yeah, they did. They were especially kind, especially considerate, and very generous. They're generous on stage, too, in terms of giving you the stage of when it's your scene of sort of sinking into the background themselves.
Which
so that
is
you
quite
can
a trick for
out.
Them, too.
It is. It really is a marvelous trick.
Much easier for me or, you know, the ordinary set. Don, you've done live theater, movies, television. Of the three, which one gives you the biggest kick, the most satisfaction?
Well, I think as an actor alone, if I were going to be an actor and only an actor for the rest of my life, I think I would choose the stage because that is the medium where the actor is in control. He has the responsibility and he has the authority because no matter what the director says and no matter what you do through the weeks of rehearsal, once that curtain goes up for 2.5 hours,
you're in charge.
It's up to you. You're in charge. You're either going to make it or you're going to blow it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in films, it's quite possible for really just adequate or even bad actors to give a good performance in film.
If the cutting is right.
If the cutting is right and if they're handled with kid gloves, if they are cast for certain elements of their own personality where they don't have to characterize,
mm-hmm.
they can actually give a very effective performance.
Yeah, there is a classic story about Victor McLaughlin, that great scene in The Informer, where
right.
they did not tell him that he was going to do that scene. They deliberately told him, we're going to be doing long shots, don't worry, the whole thing. And he came in, and he hadn't had much sleep, and he wasn't worried, and he hadn't read his lines. And then they start sitting him down and shooting these questions at him. And the bafflement on his face was quite real. He didn't
right.
know the lines.
Exactly. That's a very good point, in fact. And when you take a man like Victor McLaughlin, who had very little formal stage or theatrical acting training, he was a boxer,
mm-hmm.
light heavyweight boxer. And
I suppose the inverse is also true, then, that if you can have a good performance created, so to speak, by cutting, directing, and editing, then you can also have a good one ruined.
Oh, yeah, that's very possible. As a matter of fact, this is one of the frustrating things for a stage actor who goes into films because he very carefully sculpts his character. And, for instance, if he has a character change, to put things in its most simplest form, if he changes from a bad guy to a good guy or vice versa,
mm-hmm.
He has a certain scene that is, for him, the bridge between the bad guy and the good guy. So he very carefully plays that scene as the bridge, so it's very understandable why and how he became the good guy from the bad guy,
uh-huh.
and they cut out the bridge.
Inset shot of Gene Harlow, yeah.
Exactly, you know, and there he is. In one scene, he's a bad guy, and the next scene, he's a good guy, and the critics say he's unconvincing in his part.
Our guest, Don Murray, who's appeared on stage, on television, and in the movies. An actor who always wanted to be an actor. And now, Monitor Music. You've heard the expression, they're playing our song. Well, here's Petula Clark with a variation of her very own. This is my song.
In this world, there's you.
You're tuned to Monitor. Just ahead, Jack Jones, Ferranti and Teicher, and the full story on the mini skirt from the lady who created the style originally. So don't go away. You're on the Monitor, Beacon.
Make your play. Call sportscaster Bill Mazur. Weeknights at 5 on the big voice of Big Town USA, WNBC, New York.
Randall here for Monitor. When comedian Jackie Leonard sees a girl walk into a nightclub wearing a miniskirt, he says, "Hey, lady, you're too tall for your skirt." But he wouldn't have that line if it hadn't been for Mary Quant. She invented the miniskirt, and we'll be hearing from her shortly. And now the voice of Jack Jones singing his current bestseller called Lady.
Lady, you're in love today, but what about your broken heart tomorrow? Why waste all your loveliness on someone if he really doesn't care? Let me take you in my arms and let me love you tenderly, and you see all the joys of life you never found before you'll find with me. Lady, take my love today and let me give you a happiness forever. Every day you wait, a little love we could be sharing slips away. What you thought was love was just a brief fantasy. I'm in love with you, so lovely lady, won't you fall in love with me?
Next on Monitor, Arlene Francis, brought to you by Orlon 33 Acrylic, the DuPont fiber that never gets tired, and James Lee's Carpets. Here's Arlene.
If you've never thought of the miniskirt as a conservative fashion, you have a surprise coming in just 1 minute when we hear from England's creator of the miniskirt, Mary Quant. There's a whole new world of liveliness in carpets, and it comes to you from Lee's. Lee's new big, fat, thick Charlestown carpet. You know that soft, springy feeling most new carpets have. Well, Lee's Charlestown stays springy because it's made with pile of DuPont Orlon 33 acrylic.
Springier, fancier, it's the carpet fiber that's livelier. Springier, livelier, made by DuPont, it's Orlon 33.
Lee's Charlestown, the thick, fat, roly-poly carpet made with Orlon 33 for lasting liveliness. For a lot of good, down-to-earth reasons, choose those heavenly carpets by Lee's.
Springier, livelier, made by DuPont, it's Orlon 33.
Do you feel the miniskirt is just too much, or really too little, to be worn by any woman over 21? If you do, listen now as Monitor reporter John Cannon talks to the 30-year-old creator of the miniskirt, England's Mary Quant.
How do you explain the miniskirt? Why did you create it?
Oh, do you want the real answer?
The real answer, Mary.
I think I didn't want to grow up. I thought that little girls like 11, 12, 13 were elegant, graceful, you know. I thought their gawkiness was an attractive thing. Whereas grown-up women seemed to me terribly artificial. They walked badly because of their stiletto heels. Their hair looked like candy floss. And you felt, you know, that the whole texture, their whole point of view was ugly. I couldn't see why this needed to be so.
Well, there are those who feel that the miniskirt is very good for a very young girl, say a girl of 18, 19, 20, but that the woman of 30, 40 has a little trouble with this skirt to carry it off. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it looked great on Dietrich. I think it would look great on Jackie Kennedy or Audrey Hepburn. Whereas some teenagers have very fat, squashy legs. It's nothing to do with age.
It's legs then, isn't it?
It's legs. But many, many women have great legs. It's nothing to do with age. You see, I think women are the shape they want to be nowadays. You know, nobody needs to be fat. You know, you want to go to the doctor now. And women are a better shape. They're more sort of marvelous looking than they've ever been before.
Mary, do people ever confront you with this sort of challenge? Do they say, Mary Quad, we think this is terrible. Do they ever say that to you?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, worse than that, like, it's obscene, it's degenerate. That really used to upset me. In fact, you see, the miniskirt is really rather a Puritan fashion. Because, and again, I think they only say this when they've seen it worn the wrong way. Because short skirts have to be worn. They have to be an A shape, not tapered in anyway. And they have to be worn with tights and nearly flat shoes. Because if you wear high heels, you know, it makes the calf so sort of fat and bulgy and horrid. And tights. And some kind of, like, knickers or boxer short things to relate to the dress. So, in fact, if your underwear does show, it doesn't matter because it's part of fashion and part of the whole outfit. And so, in fact, it's a very sort of covered up, prudish fashion. You can stand on your head, it doesn't matter.
King Richard's Flugel Knights. Richard's Flugel Knights with Cabaret. Now the heartwarming story of two Americans, father and daughter, who met recently in war-torn Vietnam. Army Specialist Del Barnes interviewed them.
Arndt, how do you happen to be here in Vietnam?
I'm on my way to UNESCO mission in Bangkok, and since Chris was here at Kuchi, the Army kindly brought me out. After all, doesn't everyone stop in Saigon on his way to Bangkok?
Would you mind defining UNESCO for me?
UNESCO is the United Nations Organization for Education, Science, and Culture. It works in many countries.
Well, this isn't actually your first trip to Vietnam, is it?
No, this is a way station. Last year I was on the Bangkok tour again and stopped off in Saigon for a couple of hours.
What are your impressions of the country?
I haven't seen the country. All I've been is inside the perimeter here. It's a bit noisy, but I'm amazed how well organized the camp is.
Did you know your father was coming down?
I've known for about 2 months. Yeah, but I wasn't ever positive that I'd ever see him. Even when it came to be the last 10 minutes of him getting off the plane, I wasn't sure whether he'd be getting off or not.
Chris, I understand you're going on to Bangkok with your father, right?
Right. I've been here 7.5 months, and I'm ready to take a leave.
How long are you going to spend in the big city?
I'll be there about 8 days.
But did you have any problem arranging your leave to go along with his trip to Bangkok?
No, I'm taking leave instead of R&R, and so it's very easy since I'm going commercially.
You've just come with the 25th Division here in Kuchi about a month and a half ago, you said. How does it compare to Quinyan, where you were assigned before you came down here?
Well, Quinyan's a support command, and so it's quite different. Kuchi is forward compared to where I was before, and I find it much more interesting, a much more rewarding job working with the men who are really in the forward areas. I don't know, they're more responsive, and I feel as though we're really doing a job down here, where in Quinyan, I didn't feel quite the response that we get down here.
Mr. Gamble, how do you feel about your daughter being in Vietnam with the Red Cross?
I'm all for it. I think it's an excellent job, and I believe she'll come back to the United States with a lot of experiences that will be most helpful to her and a lot of other people.
Well, thank you very much for taking time to talk with me, Mr. J.A. Gamble and daughter Chris Gamble of Claremont, California. Have a nice trip to Bangkok, and maybe we'll see you again sometime. This is Army Specialist Al Barnes reporting from Kuchi.
A lighter moment in the grim story of Americans in Vietnam. Now, more Monitor Music.
My last with you. Don't say a word. Don't even try. It's best that we kiss. Tomorrow, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Jane Morgan with Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye, kind of a translation from the English. Come to think of it, there's one day a year when I'd like to kiss tomorrow goodbye. You know, about April 14th or so.
Monitor Radio.
And I'm Brad Crandall with a question. You want to know why a single painting can bring a price of $5 million? Well, the answer's just ahead, so stay with us on the Monitor Beacon.
WNBC New York, the big voice of Big Town USA, is the sound of conversation.
Green, green, the Greenfield way to keep your lawn in prime. Green, green, the Greenfield way to save a lot of work and time.
Calving means fun to most children. But imagine what camping means to the handicapped child. The child who, because of his braces or wheelchair, needs a camp with special facilities. Camping for crippled children is the most important aspect of the rehabilitation program supported by Easter Seals. At Easter Seal camps, trained therapists help youngsters gain self-confidence and learn new independence. But your help is needed, too. Your donation. So send it today to Easter Seals, care of your local postmaster.
Keeping you informed of facts, keeping you informed of issues, keeping you informed of people. WNBC, the big voice of Big Town USA, keeps you informed of Big Town.
Hello, Brad Crandall back with more of Monitor 67. Starting off this segment with Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet singing one of the hit songs from the musical I Do, I Do. The honeymoon is over.
When your husband doesn't touch your best dessert, when you find the purple lipstick on his shirt, then, my dear, it's clear the honeymoon is over and you better be on the alert.
When your wife decides that she should wear the pants, when she puts you down each time she gets the chance, then, my dear, it's clear the honeymoon is over and you'd better search for some romance.
Time you saw your old trusty lawyer,
when your husband suddenly becomes a swell,
when your wife is bored by every joke you tell, then, my dear, it's clear the honeymoon is over and you may.
Lady flew to America from the small country of Liechtenstein and caused more excitement than any female immigrant in recent years. Her arrival followed a transaction involving $5 million. And now, after spending her life up to now in Europe, she's taken up permanent residence in Washington, D.C. Reporter Betty Grobley talked with her friend William Morrison about the lady.
Mr. Morrison, will you explain who this lady is and why she's so valuable?
Betty, let me first say that this lady has been coveted by our director, John Walker, for the 25 years that the National Gallery has been in existence. When he was the curator there when it first opened in 1941, he said he used to wistfully dream of someday bringing the Leonardo da Vinci Ginevra da Vinci to Washington and thought, of course, that it would be impossible. And now it's happened. Briefly, the story is that when Leonardo was fairly young, though a mature man at this time, he was working with Verrocchio, the great Italian artist, and that he painted a picture of the young daughter of the Vinci family. This was a wealthy family in Florence 500 years ago. They were friends of the Medicis, for example, a merchant prince family. And Leonardo only is known to have painted some dozen or 18 pictures. At least that's all that exists today. And because of that reason, there are none in America that are generally accepted as Leonardo's, except ours now. the Ginevra da Vinci. There's little doubt. In fact, there's no doubt today that this is a great Leonardo da Vinci painting.
How did you get her?
Well, we have been after her for some time, for about a year and a half, very hard. The discussions began to look fruitful about a year ago. The picture was even given a code name at one point. Pericott, our curator, decided that we should call it The Bird. So on all the cablegrams, it went between the Prince of Liechtenstein, who we bought it from, and the United States, and in all the inter-office memos at the National Gallery in Washington, it was always referred to not as Ginevra, but as The Bird. And one cablegram in particular that we remember was one that was sent by our Secretary-Treasurer, Mr. Fiedler, back to John Walker in Washington, and in which he wanted to tell Mr. Walker the conditions under which the painting was kept in Vaduz, is where it had been, so that we could have the exact same conditions waiting for it when it arrived in Washington. The telegram read something like, "The Bird is being baked at 44 degrees and is 55% wet." So we had this suitcase that you mentioned before, which is a kind of a thermos bottle inside a suitcase with the painting inside of it, brought over under those exact conditions, and it's now in what you might think of as a decompression chamber, going through slow changes in humidity. They're being changed about every half week. We're going a few points until we'll get to the temperature and humidity conditions that we have at the National Gallery, which is about 72 degrees temperature and about something like 50% humidity. And that's why it cannot go on view until the 17th of March.
Which is St. Patrick's Day.
Which is St. Patrick's Day and our 26th anniversary, too. And it's the first acquisition of our second quarter century. Can you imagine that?
Mm. Now, how big is it?
Well, it's small. It's something like 14 or 15 inches high. It's 16 inches high and about 14 inches wide. It's not a large painting, but the Leonardo paintings are not large. It's an average-sized Leonardo picture.
William Morrison, where does the National Gallery get this kind of money?
Well, the fund we've been acquiring to purchase this picture has been underway for some time. It's private funds. A number of people contributed to it. And since we knew that there was a possibility that we could acquire it, we asked certain benefactors if we could acquire this fund, if we could get this fund together, and we did.
William Morrison, can you divorce money from art?
We try to, Betty. We try to have people come to the National Gallery and look at our paintings not as frames with dollar bills in the middle of them, but as a great work of art. It's difficult to do because the public press today needs to make it understandable to the public, and dollars and cents seems to be the way to do it. We would prefer, of course, that it simply be is thought of as one of the great works of all time, not a tremendously expensive picture.
Can you articulate, William Morrison, why it is a great work?
Well, since Leonardo only painted some dozen or 18 pictures, this depends on which expert you happen to be reading as to that number, whereas Rembrandt painted, let's say, more than 400. From the standpoint of rarity, there are just so few Leonardos that we're not saying that Leonardo is a greater artist than Rembrandt. That's not what's being said or the problem. It's the fact that there are so few of them.
We've been talking with William Morrison, who is assistant to the director of the National Gallery of Art. And you, if you come to the nation's capital, may see the painting that we've been discussing today on March the 17th. You can't forget that. St. Patrick's Day. Be ready for view. This is Betty Grobley in Washington for Monitor.
The story of a great masterpiece of art, soon to be on view here in America.
Wednesday's child is a child of woe. Wednesday's child cries alone, I know. When you smiled just for me, you smiled for a while. I forgot I was Wednesday's child, Friday's child. smiles at love, they say. In your arms, Friday was my day. Now you're gone. Well, I should have known I am Wednesday's child, born to be
singing Wednesday's Child. Now, more monitor music, strictly on the instrumental side. Herb Alpert's Wade in the Water. Listening to Monitor 67, the best weekend sound to have around the house. And in your car, too, wherever you are or wherever you go in the USA. In the area of Minneapolis and St. Paul, we're heard on KSTP. Right after a pause for a word from our NBC stations all down the line, we'll be back with more of Monitor 67.
Monitor, first and foremost in weekend radio service on the NBC Radio Network.